Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins. Coming up on today's show, Heather Digby Parton from Salon.com is going to be here to talk about whether or not Donald Trump running for president in 2024 could end up putting the brakes on the potential criminal charges that could be headed his way. It's an interesting thought, and we'll find out if it could work. We've also got major news coming out of New York with regard to the ongoing investigations into Donald Trump's real estate company. A judge this week held the real estate firm in charge of setting the values for Trump's properties in contempt of court. We'll bring you the details. And Mitch McConnell seems to think that Americans just are sitting on too darn much money. And that's why we have this apparent labor shortage, even though the country is experiencing record low unemployment. We have all of that and much more coming up on this week's show. And don't forget, for the full show every single week, go sign up and become a member at ROFpodcast.com. And for Ring of Fire every single day of the week, subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. Liz Cheney said earlier this week that there's a good possibility the January 6th committee makes multiple criminal referrals for Donald Trump. And I think anybody who's watched the hearings understands pretty obvious we've got some crimes that have been committed. But there's still that X factor out there of whether or not Trump's going to run for office, and that could throw a wrench into everything. So joining me to talk about this, as always, Heather Digby Parton from Salon.com. Heather, quite an interesting development, right? I mean, we've got pretty substantial evidence of all of these horrible things that Donald Trump has allegedly done. But all of that could kind of get thrown if he finally makes that announcement that we're all expecting really just any moment now, from now until 2024. So it's a bit of a peculiar situation, isn't it?
It's very peculiar, and he knows this very well, right? I mean, throughout the Mueller investigation, which started almost at the very beginning of his presidency, that nonstop, everyone was saying a sitting president can't be indicted. So he knew that being president was always a get-out-of-jail-free card. He knew that. He knew that there was nothing that was going to happen to him. The worst that could happen to him would be impeachment, and we know how well that worked. So, but that, you know, now he's not president anymore. So, you know, what does he hope to gain by announcing early, which is what they're talking about? So, you know, what, how does that happen? And I think I understand the logic of it. In the Mueller report, Mueller laid out a series of crimes in there of obstruction of justice. We all saw the obstruction on national TV. We saw him fire James Comey. I mean, we knew what he was doing. And yet nothing came of that, did it? I mean, the assumption in the Mueller report was, yes, we have this policy with the Department of Justice that no sitting president can be indicted. And I'm, you know, and I'm observing that. But we're putting this all in here. And it was clearly meant to be triggered when he was no longer president. And that didn't happen. They did not follow up on those crimes. He was impeached for other reasons twice. But nothing ever came of that. And he saw that and realized that he has tremendous power, political power, and political power fueled now by violence that took place on January 6th. A bunch of people who are willing to go and, you know, storm the Capitol and, you know, look, hunt down Mike Pence or Nancy Pelosi if he doesn't get his way. And all of that is weighing on the minds of the Department of Justice. And you know that it is. They're institutionalists. They care about how, you know, people perceive them, et cetera, et cetera. So he knows that that he is already, people are treading very softly on this. The minute he announces for president, suddenly he's a candidate. Suddenly we're in a political situation. He feels, and you know, I frankly don't blame him. If you look at the performance of the Department of Justice so far, you know, he thinks that this will offer him some protection against whatever. And this includes Georgia as well. What's happening down there, which is a criminal investigation, he thinks he would be protected at least somewhat from that. I mean, he doesn't have strict legal protection, but he has political protection from that. So I honestly think that that is the main reason. I mean, there are others. He's got Ron DeSantis breathing down his neck. He's got Mike Pompeo running around in circles. You know, he's got Nikki Haley out there going to Iowa and New Hampshire. And he's got that. And there is some signs that big donors are starting to take a look, especially at DeSantis, and going, you know, well, hey, you know, this guy looks pretty good. And they're starting to, you know, send some money his DeSantis's way, which Trump hates more than anything. He wants all the money, every penny. That's part of it too, of course. But he could wait. I mean, we're still a long way from 2024. He could wait. But this, I think, and especially his, the new urgency that seems to be coming, is for after, I think, he saw what happened in the January 6th committee hearings. He felt, and I think we, you know, we all saw it, there was a shift in the dynamic after Cassidy Hutchinson testified, that there are people on the inside who were going to talk. Now that you've got Pat Cipollone getting ready to talk as well, I mean, we'll see. I mean, he's always been a good soldier up to now, but you never know. Maybe he doesn't want to lie under oath. You know, who knows? He might be one of those rare Trump people who won't lie under oath. But, you know, he sensed that he needs to start moving now and start to protect himself from, you know, any kind of legal, you know, sort of consequences for his actions, especially with Liz Cheney out there saying, yeah, we're going to refer. We got a lot of referrals. Some you don't even know about. I mean, basically, that's what she was saying. There's lots of referrals here, lots of crimes that we're aware of. And he heard that. And so, yeah, I think there's a good chance that he's going to announce early. I mean, maybe they'll talk him out of it. They don't want him to do it because they'll ruin. Well, he won't necessarily ruin. He will damage their chances in November in the midterms.
Yeah.
If he does.
And we're already seeing, you know, plenty of Republican actions that are damaging, you know, some of their midterm chances here, and just some of the candidates in general. I mean, between J.D. Vance and Dr. Oz and Herschel Walker, Democrats, to me, actually look like, hey, we're going to pick up some Senate seats here. I mean, based on polling right now, but Republicans aren't doing too good in those Senate races. And Trump throwing his hat in, suddenly becoming the focal point of everything from that point forward, that's certainly going to hurt it. And, you know, mentioning Herschel Walker, Georgia, you know, that Georgia investigation you mentioned, Fannie Willis, who's doing a phenomenal job. Like, absolutely, if Merrick Garland ever leaves his post, there's a perfect person right there to show you how to do it. This week, we got some subpoenas from her for all of Donald Trump's friends, including Lindsey Graham. So that investigation really is heating up. And honestly, if I were Trump, I would almost be more afraid of that one, because the other one, as you pointed out, you know, that depends on the DOJ, who is, oh, we've got a, there's memos that say we can't prosecute a sitting president, and we're a little iffy on getting into the political waters. But Fannie Willis is like, no, screw this. We've got some serious stuff here that's on tape. I've pulled in Brian Kemp. I've pulled in Brad Raffensperger. I'm going to subpoena a sitting, you know, U.S. senator. I'm not scared of anybody. So I think Trump should be scared of her, because she has done great work, and she's got a couple of attorneys working on her team who are experts in racketeering. She brought them in. I mean, you don't just do that for the heck of it. I think she's got a good case here. I think she's building a great one.
It sure looks that way. I mean, we've seen a lot of the evidence already, right? I mean, we heard the tape. I mean, everybody was saying when she did the subpoenas the other day, and she subpoenaed Rudy Giuliani, all of his Kraken lawyers, I think, except for Sidney Powell,
yeah.
But who is the Kraken lawyer. But all the rest of them are also Kraken lawyers. She subpoenaed all of them, and some that we weren't all that familiar with, too, which is kind of interesting. And you know, I think everybody was saying, well, they need to subpoena Trump. And that would be great if they did, and he, you know, but he's not going to do it. He'll fight it to the end of his days. But nonetheless, it would be a satisfying thing to see. But she doesn't need to, because she's got him on tape. And Raffensperger there, and I think there was someone else on the call. I can't remember who it was. I guess it was Cleta Mitchell, one of the lawyers. But she's got other people who, you know, can testify to what he personally did. And then, of course, there is that tape, which we've all heard. And so she doesn't really need him to testify. They could, you know, to get a grand jury indictment, she certainly doesn't need him to do it. And yes, that I think that case is very, very serious. And there's an interesting aspect to this, which I haven't heard discussed too much. One of the reasons for the subpoenas is a lot of it is around this hearing that Rudy Giuliani held with Georgia officials right after the election, in which he, you know, smeared Ruby Freeman and her daughter Shay Moss, who we saw testify on the January 6th committee, very movingly. But what he was also saying there, you know, I mean, he was going, you know, on and on about all the cheating and what have you, and he made the alleged cheating, and he made a bunch of false claims, which were instantly refuted by Raffensperger's office. I'm sure that that was brought up in the grand jury, and all of that is a big central part of her case, it appears. Because two of the other people, I think Jenna Ellis and somebody else, one of the other lawyers, also appeared at that, you know, that hearing. And other lawmakers that were there have also apparently testified to what they said. So that's a big central part of it. But it isn't the only thing. Another part of it is she subpoenaed this guy named Kenneth Chesbrough, who is a lawyer that nobody had heard of until recently. At least I shouldn't say nobody. I hadn't anyway. He was not one of the central players but that we knew about. But apparently he was. And he was central to the fake elector scheme. He was apparently the one who drew up the template for the fake elector affidavits and all this stuff. And in Georgia specifically, he was on the horn with the head of the Republican Party telling the fake electors to stay mum, try and get into the Georgia State House and don't tell anybody why they were there, which is, you know, if that's not consciousness of guilt, I don't know what is. And so she's on this fake elector thing, too. She is investigating that part of it, which is very interesting because that's the one case we know, other than the January 6th defendants, you know, the actual insurrection defendants, that the DOJ is investigating. We know that because they sent subpoenas to a bunch of people all over the country, and including John Eastman and Jeffrey Clark, the Department of Justice official that Trump was trying to make turn into attorney general. And he was also sending letters to Georgia. And the Department of Justice subpoenaed all these people all over the country who were involved in this fake elector scheme. So the fake elector scheme is turning out to be kind of a central focus of both the Fannie Willis's case down there in Georgia and the Department of Justice. And I think there's more to it maybe than we even realize, although I can say one thing. If it is proven that they did this thing, and I think it's pretty obvious that they did, it's the greatest electoral fraud conspiracy in United States history. They tried to overturn the Electoral College with fake votes. Okay? I mean, it doesn't. Now, the irony of that is so thick you have to cut it with a chainsaw because, you know, the stop the steal big lie is all about fake electors, and here they were actually doing it. But of course, everything they do is really nothing more than projection, right? I mean, they're always, whatever they accuse others of doing, they're doing themselves. So very interesting stuff.
Exactly. And, you know, speaking of the people subpoenaed, you know, with the fake elector scheme, you also, I don't know if it was late last week or early this week, where you had Olivia Troy and Karen Fan, who is the Republican leader in the state Senate in Arizona. They got hit with subpoenas. Karen Fan, of course, is the one who really pushed and got approved that Cyber Ninjas ballot mm-hmm. audit. So all of the little cockroaches, you know, are have been exposed from under this rotting log. And at the top of it, the king cockroach is Donald Trump himself, because at this point, you know, you can't look at any of this and think that Trump didn't know what was going on. I mean, with this fake elector scheme, it's all of his lawyers involved in this, you know, from Chesbrough to Eastman. And again, as you said, Chesbrough is one that few people know about. But you've got Eastman, you've got Giuliani, you've got Jenna Ellis. It is weird, like you said, that Sidney Powell didn't get subpoenaed. Maybe they just figure, look, she's so kooky that we don't even want to go there. Like, let's not even waste our time with this person. But I think it'd be a lot of fun for her to come in and talk to the grand jury because, it's just, yeah, it's not going to go well. But just the level of criminal activity, you know, that we have seen is still mind blowing. And what's even more to me, and I know you and I have talked about this, is we don't even know yet. We still don't even know. You know, every time there's a new hearing from this committee, we learn, oh, wow, okay, this person, and this person was also involved. Oh, now we've got these names. This is so big and so broad that I don't even know if we're ever going to truly know all of the players, just because there are so many. But this was a grand conspiracy. I mean, I struggle to call it anything other than that, because of the number of people involved, the levels at which they sat, from the chief of staff, sitting members of Congress, a U.S. senator, lawmakers in Georgia, Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania, just everywhere people were involved in this, all to make the host of The Apprentice a second-term president. It's insane.
It's absolutely insane. And you're absolutely right. You know, Liz Cheney, in her very first speech that she made as the co-chair of the January 6th committee, in that big public, the first primetime public hearing, she said, she called it a massive, well-organized conspiracy. And my ears pricked up when I heard that, because I thought, well-organized, it all seems like it was, you know, just kind of chaotic, trying this, trying that, trying the other. But they're putting together a case that it really was pretty well-organized. I mean, it wasn't organized in the sense of this will happen, then this will happen, then this will happen. It was more like, well, we'll try this, and then we have plan B over here, and then we'll go in this direction. And then if we can get these people to do that, then we'll do that. But if that doesn't work, then we'll do this. And that is, you know, organized. I mean, that is that someone that they actually, you know, sat down and kind of thought through. And I don't know if they thought through in advance, but as things were unfolding, at the very least, they were thinking through how to go about this. You know, if certain things worked and then certain things didn't work, and how they could do that. Donald Trump was in the middle of all of it. And I just don't think, I mean, you know, it's so bizarre to me, and has been from the very beginning. Well, we can't really hold him responsible because he's so dumb that he doesn't know anything. You know, he's so incredibly incompetent and stupid that, you know, he couldn't possibly have been involved in something like this because he didn't understand what was going on. Well, he was the president of the United States, for God's sake. If that's true, that he's so stupid that he didn't know all these people were putting together this conspiracy around him and telling him what they were doing and telling him that it was all a lie and that he hadn't really lost the election. And he's so stupid that he couldn't understand anything anybody was telling him. God help us that they would put this guy back in the White House again. I mean, at the very least, even if that is their best defense, which it is, because they have no other defense, you know, that it should be disqualifying. But as we know, it's not, because they, you know, the Republicans are benefiting in many ways from what Trump has wrought. And looking to the future, they are hopeful that they can get in place. I mean, that's one thing that's a little different about 2022. They don't have all the pieces in place to do what they would like to do. The Supreme Court hasn't ruled yet on, you know, particularly this one case they're going to take next year will not apply to the 2022 election. And the one case I'm referring to is this independent state legislature case, in which they are poised to say that state legislatures have plenary power over elections, meaning they can overturn them or do whatever they want. And there's no recourse in the state, the Supreme Court being the only place where they can go for a final word. So, I mean, it's a very, very, very dangerous situation. And a lot of people are sounding the alarms, including people like J. Michael Luttig, the conservative's ex-federal judge who testified at the January 6th hearing. They're all going, "What? This is bad. This is really, really bad. Don't do this. Don't do it." And they're trying various ways to try and influence the court. Those things like that, and having people in place that they're trying to get in place in 2022 into these very important election offices, like secretaries of state and officials, you know, that actually are working at the local level, that won't be in place on this election. So this election is kind of, in some ways, our last chance to sort of, you know, for democracy to survive. So Republicans are in an odd place here because they want to win in 2022, but they don't have all the rigging in place that they are willing to let happen by believing in the big lie and by refusing to sort of disassociate themselves from Donald Trump, because they know that's going to benefit them down the road. Even if they get rid of Trump, they're going to have this system in place that will help them win elections in the future. So, you know, they're in kind of an odd situation. But, you know, this is what we're looking at. I mean, this is a very, 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 you know, very difficult future for our election systems if these people are allowed to win in November. And, you know, we can only hope that Donald Trump being on the ballot, along with the issues of abortion, gun rights, you know, various other things that have sort of suddenly awakened the Democratic base to the threat, and the polling seems to suggest that it has given voters a reason to kind of go, well, you know, maybe we need to get out there again like we did in 2018 and 2020. If they do, then they have a chance because they haven't set up the system that would block Democrats from winning. And they need to, because if they don't get the right people into these state offices, governorships, secretaries of state, local offices in these states, the swing states I'm talking about, of course. I mean, I'm talking about Pennsylvania and Michigan and Georgia and Arizona and, you know, Wisconsin. Those states, if they can maintain some Democratic presence in there, they may be able to hold off this sort of, you know, anti-democracy movement that is building in these red states and make it possible for Democrats to actually win elections in the future. I mean, that's all that's at stake. Not much.
Yeah. You know, and I think what's really interesting too, and this is, you know, along those same lines, is the fact that the way Donald Trump attempted to pull this off, obviously it all started with the lying about, I didn't actually lose. Just nothing but fraud everywhere. You can't swing a dead cat without hitting some fraud here. But now we see it happening all the time. Not the fraud, of course. We just see these claims by any Republican that loses. I mean, in primaries, we got people that are getting like 5% of the vote. And they're saying, well, I'm not going to concede because obviously this election was stolen from me. No, you're a wacko. Two people voted for you. But this is how it is now. That his actions in 2020 forever changed elections, you know, and we're always going to see this now. There's always going to be these candidates who are going to go out there and claim, no, I didn't actually lose. It was rigged against me.
Right.
Let's melt the voting machines down and let's get these people out of it. Let's throw out the mail-in ballots because I didn't like this is a whole new game.
It is.
And again,
it's delegitimizing the opposition. I think that's really the point.
Yeah, it is. And it's still, I have trouble wrapping my head around the fact that all of this happened because we put the guy from The Apprentice in the White House. I mean,
I love that.
I still have these moments where I guess it kind of crystallizes. And I'm like, my God, that guy was the president of the United States. Even still a year and a half after he's gone, I still kind of, it'll hit me every now and then like, what in the hell? And we've let it happen. It could happen again. You know, that's the even more terrifying part. Excuse me. Knowing how bad he is, seeing everything he's done, all of the lawsuits that he's facing, all of the investigations that he's facing. And as of right now, he's still at the top of the Republican ticket. I mean, DeSantis is, you know, closing the gap, but it's still a 30-point gap, even with DeSantis surging, you know, nationwide. Obviously, DeSantis has the one New Hampshire poll where he's doing well.
Right.
And he's got $110 million, DeSantis does. Trump has, I think, $107. So DeSantis has more money, but We're either going to have Trump again or even worse Trump, you know, more capable, more competent Trump, which is what DeSantis is. So we've watched this Republican Party go down this horrendous path that they just keep getting worse with. I mean, that's what's horrible to me is, yes, it's great if we can get Trump gone, get him out of there, but we still have the horrible members of Congress. They're not going anywhere. Most of them are in safe districts. You know, the only one who I think is in any trouble is Matt Gaetz, not because he won't win an election, but because Greenberg, some news out this week, things aren't looking good for Gaetz for being a free man much longer.
Oh, I hope that's true.
Right. And I'll tell you, look, I'm in his district. These people would still vote for him, even if he got indicted before the election. They would still say, well, it's better than a Democrat. So that's terrifying. But all of it is just, is it irreversible? I feel like it's irreversible with the Republican Party. You know, we don't have, I don't even want to give them credit, but we don't have any more Liz Cheney's out there. And it's crazy that Liz Cheney is now considered a moderate, that Mitt Romney is now a moderate. The guy who said corporations are people, my friend. I have binders full of women. And that's now the sane voice of the Republican Party. And they're becoming the minority at an incredibly alarming rate, which just pushes us even further down this, you know, horrible path with what we've got as a Republican Party.
That's right. I mean, it, you know, even Liz Cheney said, I think over the weekend, she said something like, you know, this, the Republican Party, you know, cannot survive. There are other people who are saying the Republican Party, you know, must, people like, you know, I think it's Tim Miller, you know, the ex, you know, Republican operative who now writes for the Bulwark, and he's on TV all the time. He has a new book out. And I think he's one who says the Republican Party must die. It has to go. It's too fully corrupted to be able to reform itself. There, it's, you know, and there's no reason that it has to continue. I mean, it's entirely possible for someone, and I would not, I was just thinking about this the other day, you know, so Liz Cheney refused to rule out running for president. I mean, she's going to lose her race. That's almost inevitable. I'd be shocked if she didn't. She'd be shocked if she didn't. So they were asking her, what do you plan to do? Will you run for president? She says, well, I'm not thinking about that just yet. So that wasn't exactly a hard Sherman-esque no, right? I mean, she's thinking about it. But I could see her running as a third party and deciding that, look, you know, maybe we're better off, even a hardcore conservative like her. I mean, don't get me wrong. On policy level, you and I are not going to like, you know, the Liz Cheney party.
Right.
And none of us are going to vote for Liz Cheney. But if she may have made the calculation, and especially observing what she's observed, both with about Trump and about the reaction of her party to Trump and how they have, you know, sort of, you know, misinformed and propagandized and indoctrinated the base of the party in this weird sense that we cannot lose. We cannot possibly be losers ever. They must be cheating. I mean, this whole view that is now sort of just inculcated into the entire Republican base. She may have observed that and recognized that the party has to go. And in order to do that, it'll take a transition. It won't just die overnight. There's got to be another party. I mean, that's going to happen. We may not be a multi-party country, but we are a two-party country at least. So that's probably going to happen. But it would take a transition. And if Liz Cheney were to run as a third party, that would split the Republicans. It might deny Donald Trump the election if there were enough people that, you know, enough Republicans and, you know, Republican-leaning independents. You know, hopefully, God help us, I hope Democrats don't vote for her. But if she was able to do that, and it would be, you know, she'd be actually doing a patriotic thing, because destroying her own party and denying Donald Trump another term would be, that's a brave thing to do. And she's not stupid. She'd know what she was doing, right? I mean, she's not someone who's just naively going, oh, I think they're all going to vote for me. I mean, she knows what position she's in. And to take the slings and arrows, that would be, oh my, you don't even want to think about what the Republicans would do to her if she did that. But that's kind of, I think, maybe the way that the only way out for us is if the Republican Party actually does split. And I don't know how split it would be. Maybe it would only be 20%. But that denies them the election if that happens. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. So we basically need Liz Cheney to play the role that Ross Perot played in 1992, 1996 even. You know, he pulled enough So we'll say, look, hey, Liz Cheney, if you're out there, if you're listening,
run.
I'll throw some money at you if you're going to do a third party run. You know, I will do my best to not trash you so you can take some Republican votes, because, you know, you look at the polling numbers on the Biden side. We need a Ross Perot. we need something, because it's not looking so good over here on the left with the polling, and the people are getting mad. And you've even, you know, Deborah Messing is getting mad. And when you lose Deborah Messing, you're in trouble. But listen,
you're in a mess.
you really are. So, again, Liz Cheney, we're here for it all day. If you want to throw your hat in on the third party, you've got plenty of time to think about it probably after November.
So. Yeah, I think so. I think she does.
But listen, Heather Digby Parton, a phenomenal conversation. I always love talking with you. So thank you very much for joining us once again here on Ring of Fire.
My pleasure. It's always fun. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Thank you. And that's all for the free portion of this week's show. But if you want the full show every single week, go sign up and become a member at ROFpodcast.com. In addition to getting the weekly full show, you also get access to the entirety of the Ring of Fire podcast archives. It is a great value, and it's a great way to help support what we do here at Ring of Fire.